You're listening to a Why Now podcast.
This is the Worldwide Will Show on whynow.co.uk. I'm your host, Will. I'm a British Army veteran of just short of 11 years and served numerous tours of Afghanistan. In this show, I'll be speaking to former members of the British Armed Forces and Coalition Forces, giving them a platform of which to tell their life story, as well as experiences and how it's affected them. I hope you enjoy the show. Alright guys, welcome to the Worldwide Will Show. I'm joined by...
Stephen Egan, pothead extraordinaire.
Pothead extraordinaire, all the way from America.
From America.
America. So, as you guys know, this is a podcast to tell people's life story. I believe everyone's life is a story, and it's down to them to tell it. So I'll pass you over to Stefan, and we'll roll from there. How you doing, buddy?
Fantastic, Will. Thanks for having me on the Worldwide Will Show.
Hey, no worries, no worries.
So I was born in Tampa, Florida.
Nice.
In 1986. And my mom and dad were... high school sweethearts. My dad's side of the family was the local outlaw side that had a chop shop in the back of their back of their property, breaking down cars and selling the parts and shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And my grandfather was also a cannabis cultivator. So my dad would sell weed to all the high school kids, and that's what my mom and I together.
Yeah.
It's actually the valedictorian. So it was a weird combination.
Yeah.
He ended up being a violent, violent asshole, and he beat the shit out of her all the time. Mm. She ended up having three kids with him. So my dad and I had three brothers, mm-hmm. right? We moved around all the time. He beat the shit out of my mom. He beat the shit out of us. They ended up splitting up.
Yeah.
And we ended up moving to New York out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. My mom was from there, so she felt that if she could go back to her childhood days,
the home base.
Maybe things would get easier, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we moved there, and random men would come in and out. I called it she's a love gypsy. Basically, like, you know, any man that would take care of us, uh-huh. she would allow into the house, and that was that. She just needed that support, you know.
Yeah.
It is what it is. In the beginning, it was hard to, how do you say, it was hard to know what a man was,
right,
or what a man's supposed to be, because here I am as a teenage kid now,
uh-huh.
with all these different guys coming in, and they're all just here after one thing.
There's no solid role model, really. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I played sports and stuff, and I would get, like, my male camaraderie from all the other kids.
Sure.
So over time, I started piecing together who I was mm-hmm, mm-hmm. from my friends' dads, like, picking apart, like, oh, this is a good characteristic, mm-hmm. that's a good characteristic. Mm-hmm. Trying to figure out my own path, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When I got 16, I was playing football, and I blew out my knee.
No shit.
I was going to, I had a scholarship, it was actually 17, I had a scholarship to the University of Florida.
Oh, wow.
Which are the Gators.
Mm-hmm.
And I blew my knee out and was prescribed Oxycontin.
Right.
So.
And that's an opioid, right? That's an opioid drug, right?
Yeah. So here I am. I'm 17 years old now, and my whole life was riding on me playing football, getting out of this shitty environment I was in. Mm-hmm. You know, this time my mom had cancer already.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working full-time and going to school, trying to pay bills at the house, go to school, and go fulfill my dreams and all that shit. And then I get blown out and I get drugs. And these things were amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And took everything away. And then at 16, 17 years old, I'm like, fuck. Like, mm-hmm. I can take these, function, do everything I need to do,
mm-hmm.
and people want to buy them. Cool. I can make some money, too. Now everything's all set.
Right? Yeah.
At that time, in Florida now, we moved back to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Let me back up a little bit. So we moved to New York. I was in kindergarten at the time.
Sure.
From New York, we moved to West Virginia.
Yep.
Lived there for about 2 years. From West Virginia, we moved to Pennsylvania. While we were in West Virginia, my mom met a college football player.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought he was going to be her meal ticket. So she followed him around.
Yeah.
He ended up getting her pregnant. So he lost his ride because he had to take care of the kid. So they wouldn't provide for his college anymore.
Oh,
so he lost his ride, ended up going to a school back in Pennsylvania, who ended up giving him a part-time, partial scholarship.
Yeah.
He couldn't maintain the grades, so he got kicked out of school. Now we're a family of four kids and two adults trying to figure this shit out.
Fucking
like, he's got no college education.
Yeah.
My mom does, but she's a single parent.
Yeah.
Trying to make it all work. So we move into, like, this shanty of a house in this little town called Fleetwood, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
We live there for about 2 or 3 years. Then we move all the way to Minnesota because there's some new opportunity out there.
Yeah.
We go to Minnesota. We're there for like 3 or 4 years. Then we move down to Florida. I start high school in Florida. So my 9th grade freshman year of high school is in Florida.
Yeah.
And that's when I really started taking on to athletics and football and everything else, uh-huh. just because my life was so shit.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be home. So we focused all my energy in just playing sports and going down that path.
Things like most kids do. That sort of emotion can be a very good drive as well, you know? Mm-hmm. And it clearly was because you got a scholarship out of it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it was all I did. It was all I cared about. Mm-hmm. And when we moved to Florida, you know, being the new kid in school and being able to show off a little bit and these are my skills, and it was, you know, the new kid is awesome. So
yeah.
Became real popular. And from that point on, it was just football, high school parties and girls and hanging out, just that typical high school mm-hmm. thing, you know, mm-hmm. it was fantastic. And then when I blew my knee out, then the drugs came in.
Yeah.
You know, I'd smoke weed and stuff beforehand, but that's normal. Yeah. It's nothing crazy. But once the opiates started coming in,
that's a whole new level.
It got crazy really fast. Yeah. And a group of friends, we started selling lots of opiates. Uh-huh. We were doctor shopping. We had people going to the doctor for us. We were pulling in like 5,000 oxys a month.
Fuck.
Like, it was ridiculous. At one point, we were making like 20,000 a month in high school.
Just for the UK listeners, like, so over here, in order to get like prescription drugs, you have to go to the GP, the general practice doctor. Mm-hmm. And they have to see you and then be like, yes, you need these drugs. Here's your prescription. You go to the prescription, you pay for the prescription, mm-hmm. then you get it. But it's literally, you'll get maybe a week, maybe right. 2 weeks if you're lucky. And then you have to go and revisit them. So right. over the US, because it's private, is it much mm-hmm. easier to get hold of these sort of drugs?
Yeah, so basically the way it works is you go to a GP.
Yeah.
And the GP will say, you go, you say, hey, look, I have this problem. It's chronic. Mm-hmm. And the GP says, that's beyond my purview. Mm-hmm. I will recommend you to pain management.
Right.
Once you have that recommendation, you're in. It's over. Like, the game's done. All yeah. you have to do is show up.
You're now a dealer.
Exactly. Well, it's that simple. You go, you take that recommendation. And yeah. at that point, there was a bunch of doctors. And you just took your pick. And you went to the ones that were cash only.
Yeah,
and you would pay for the visit, and then you would pay per prescription, right? Because these doctors knew what they were doing. They know what they're doing. So you go to the pain management doctors, and they're specialized. Okay, their whole purpose in life is to provide pain management to people. Mm-hmm. The other aspect is typically they are a dietary supplement facility as well.
Right.
So they manage weight control, and they manage pain. So their whole purpose in life is just to distribute narcotics,
sure.
like amphetamines and opiates. Here you go.
Sure.
Right. So we would go to these doctors and at 6, 17 years old, getting out, you know, 400 Oxycontins, 120 Xanax. Like it was just astronomical amounts of pills. Fast forward a little bit till about 2004.
Yeah.
Florida started catching up. They started mm-hmm. catching on to what was going on. Mm-hmm. And a few of my friends got rolled up. And they got pinched, right. and one of them ended up dying from an overdose. Shit. Once everyone started falling off, I kind of disappeared and sure. moved back up to Minnesota.
Yeah.
And I graduated high school in Florida, and the moment I graduated, I moved back to Minnesota. And that's where I met my wife, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Growing up, though, up to that point, it was interesting because my dad wasn't really in my life much.
Sure.
At all. Like, I would always seek him out. Mm-hmm. Because as a child, you want.
Of course. Yeah, you need it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and especially even now, being a 33-year-old man, seeing my dad, not seeing him for 25 years, like, I still want his approval in some aspect.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Really strange, right?
Yeah.
Like, you still seek that for some reason.
But it's mad, because I went into boxing just to please a father that was never in my life. Right. So, like, my father, he was quite a big boxer in Wales at the time. But he liked the drink too much, and he lost the Welsh ABA final to a big boxer who's now retired, but uh-huh. he's a huge boxer now from Wales. But he hit the drink straight after that, and that's what ultimately finished him and my mother together. But like 16 years on, 17, 18 years on, I was doing boxing in the army just to say, look, I've won this boxing fight, to try and please him. And I didn't know why, but I was doing it, right. You know, as an adult. Right.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
If I learned anything, and I say this often from my dad, it's like, I learned what not to be.
100%.
And I think that's just as important as learning what to be, right? Because I learned how not to treat women. I learned how not to abuse drugs and things, and later on in life. And 100%. Things like, I learned some valuable lessons on how not to be a man.
I mean, although I love my stepdad, I've learned more how not to be a dad from him and my real dad than how to be a dad, if that makes sense. But then
absolutely.
How not to be is how to be, you know?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I met my wife in Minnesota, right? In junior high school, first off. Then we moved to Florida. I went to high school, graduated, moved back to Minnesota after the knee injury and all that, and started working and reconnected with my wife. And
how old are you now? You're 18 now?
At this time, I am 18 years old. 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
She was actually in a relationship with someone. And because I was gone, you know? And it's like, what are you going to do, right?
So sure.
When I got back, though, we were hanging out all the time. And
her boyfriend loved that.
What are you doing with him all the time, you know? So it ended up just kind of steaming out over there, and she ended up spending all the time with me.
Yeah.
But it got to a point where I was falling back into old habits. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily using drugs, but finding ways to make quick, easy money.
Sure.
And that's not what she wanted. That's not the world she came from.
Uh-huh.
So seeing the person that she was with before me, and that he was going to school to be like an accountant or whatever the fuck he was doing, I was like, she can't, this isn't going to work, right? So that's what kind of forced me to join the Army.
Right.
Was this girl who needed stability as much as I did, and so I joined the military. You know, and I remember going to basic training and her sending me letters and me getting in trouble by the drill sergeants because she'd spray perfume on them.
It was a mess.
But it was worth it because it gave me that extra drive I needed. But I joined the Army as a truck driver, actually, initially. It was an 88 Mike.
So in the British military, if you're going to be like a driver, per se, you join the Royal Logistics Corps. So it's called the RLC. I mean, we call it the really lazy corps, but, you know, RLC.
You see me, I'm built like a softball. Absolutely.
So what did you join in terms of sort of, what regiment was it? Or is it each regiment have their own drivers? How does it work?
No, the Army, the U.S. Army is a bit different, right? So when you join the military, you get given a job.
Okay.
Based on your scores on the test that you take, you're given a job.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes if you test well, you get to pick your job. I tested really well, but I wanted to get to Iraq as fast as possible.
Right.
At the time, IEDs were blowing everyone up, and truck drivers were falling off quite rapidly.
Yep.
So they gave me a very big bonus of $35,000 cash at the time.
Shit.
To sign a contract and go to Iraq and drive trucks.
That's like a dangling carrot that's dipped in gold, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. To a 19, 20-year-old kid.
Fucking hell. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I signed the contract. I went to basic. When you, like I said, when you become a truck driver, you're part of a regiment, logistics regiment, but it's not an important thing to be a part of it, right?
Yeah.
Because you belong to a unit,
right.
Or a brigade or a division, and that takes precedence.
Sure.
So all your logistics corps stuff isn't located in one spot.
Mm-hmm.
It's attached to the Army units, right?
Right.
So we're all commingled together.
Sure.
I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma for basic training.
Yep.
And it's in the middle of the U.S. and it's fucking like 120 degrees in the summertime. It's miserable. Just miserable. Oh, God, I hated that place. And then from there, I went to Fort Bliss, Texas, which is down in El Paso, Texas. Now, I went there for truck driving school, which is unique because they only opened that up for like 2 years for truck driving schools.
All right.
Because of the massive amount of soldiers they were pushing through the training to get to war, they opened new training facilities. I don't think it's operational anymore. So after base or AIT, which is where you learn to drive your vehicles, I went to Fort Stewart, Georgia.
Yeah.
I was attached to 164 Armor, 3rd Infantry Division.
Yep.
As an 80 Mike truck driver, and I deployed to Iraq like 2 months after I got there. I remember getting my unit orders while I was in AIT before I went to Georgia. and it told me I was going to 2nd Brigade, 3rd ID, and, like, their logo was a bulldog, and it had, a, like, a banner, and his banner said, send me. I was like, oh, damn it, this is actually happening. I'm really going, you know?
Shit, I'm so going to earn that 35K, right?
Yeah, right? Yeah. And I'm going to have to work for it now. I got to Fort Stewart, and I remember I got this in briefing, and I'll never forget this guy. He's like, this major. He's like, you know, don't get it twisted. Regardless of what your job is, you're a soldier.
Yeah.
You're here to kill people.
Yeah.
That's your first job, is to kill people.
Well, I mean,
and I'll never forget that.
Yeah. I mean, he's not wrong. I mean.
No. So after I got to Stewart, I deployed for my first time to Baghdad, Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also pushed down support to a place called Sadr City in Iraq.
Okay.
That first deployment was extremely, extremely eye-opening for me. You know, I was a kid that went around the states from state to state with my mom, thinking that I was versatile, that I'd seen the world, so to speak, and yeah. I knew what to expect from things. And when I got to Iraq, it was, I mean, it's a whole new fucking world.
Yeah, like, I think everyone's first tour that actually goes beyond the wire is a massive eye-opener. Because you think you're this fucking badass, and then all of a sudden you're thrown into an actual fucking big boy's world,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, like, that's really a dead body over there.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah. Like, that person died a couple weeks ago, and he's laying on the road. Like, that's a crater in the street. Yeah. Someone got hit. Yeah, like, it got real, real quick, you know?
Mm.
And then being a truck driver and getting hit with IEDs, or your convoy getting hit,
mm-hmm.
every other day, shit just got real,
yeah.
real fast, you know?
Yeah.
Shortly after that, we experienced a catastrophic IED hit, actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what ended up happening was we got 4 people got hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring this up because I always had my wife stay completely clear of the Army's FRG, which is the Family Readiness Group.
Okay.
Basically, we deploy, like, all the family and wives get together, and they pass disseminated information so
yeah.
they know what's going on the front lines.
Yeah.
We took a catastrophic hit. 4 people in a Humvee died.
Yeah.
They didn't pass out the names yet, but the FRG leader was like, yo, we just took a massive casualty. We don't know who they are yet. Just be prepared.
That's the worst thing ever.
And then the husband.
Their husband.
The FRG leader's husband, Major Brookshire, was the one that bought it that day, along with 3 other kids from the headquarters company. But
yeah.
it just was one of those things where it validated for me to my wife, like, this isn't, you know, high school clique girlfriend groups anymore. This is real for everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know? It was a twisted rotation. It wasn't, you know, I was a young soldier at the time. I was a private.
Yeah.
I left that deployment as a specialist, which is an E4.
Okay.
You know, I didn't know much what was going on as far in the big Army world, right?
Yeah.
What was going on intel side, what was going on operations side. I just knew what was going on, like,
ground
in front of us.
Right there.
We were a forward support company. We were putting concrete barriers on the street to deter people and just random bullshit, you know?
You're trying to survive the day, and that's it.
Exactly. You know, we would get tasked. There was this place called the Killing Fields. It was like this square block area of just this desert field thing with houses all around it. And the insurgents would just dump bodies there. So they would call it the Killing Fields.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Every month, a certain platoon would get tasked with going out and cleaning out the Killing Fields.
Fuck, man.
So it was all about the hearts and minds, you know? And so we would spend time just fucking cleaning out bodies and throwing them in trucks. And I just remember this one time I picked up this fucking child. Like, he was 7, 8 years old, and the skin just slid right off of his legs.
Fucking hell,
man. And
put
him in the truck. And from that moment, like, that next day I went home on leave.
Yeah.
And, like, we get 17 days of leave.
Okay.
After, you know, while we're deployed or whatever. And, like, I couldn't come home,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I mean. Like, I got home.
But you weren't home.
But I was not home.
Yeah.
And it was just, like, the most horrible home leave experience I've ever had.
Yeah.
You know, like, trying to bond with your spouse and be with your family. And
yeah.
You're just not there.
The thing is, they expect you to be the person you were before you left.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you ever are. You try to be, but yeah, it's impossible. Did you notice a difference in yourself at that point? Or it's quite hard to notice a change, because back then I didn't think I was any different. But right. I didn't notice until after like my fucking second tour. And you're talking, because I did summer on, summer off, but so that's 3 years, and that's a lot. That's a big time to think you're okay, but you're not okay. You know,
mm-hmm.
especially when you put two tours in. Mm-hmm. So did you notice a change in yourself, or had others noticed and mentioned it, or not even mentioned it?
So I remember specifically, actually, I had a conversation with my section sergeant at the time.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, just something's not right. Like, I'm fucking angry all the time.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't have patience. Like, mm-hmm. I want to hurt things,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know? And he's like, you're fine, man. That's normal. You're fine. And I remember saying something after that to my wife, but not as in detail.
Mm-hmm.
That weekend, I went out with my wife, my section sergeant, and his wife. He then took it upon himself to go to my wife and say, you know, your husband thinks he's not okay, but he's fine. So at that point, my wife was thinking, this is normal. He should be experiencing what he's going through.
Mm-hmm.
The section sergeant says, it's okay, it's normal. Mm-hmm. We don't need to check anything out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the beginning of our long road back.
Right,
because
right.
From that moment, we were both like, I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
So for 3 years after that point, I just rocked steady. Now I'm recruiting intelligence. Now I'm going down that path.
Mm-hmm.
Rocking up, we're deploying nonstop. Like, mm-hmm. this is our world, baby. Mm-hmm. You know, and it didn't click that something was extremely wrong with me until I got back from Afghanistan, actually.
Mm-hmm.
When I met you,
yeah.
after that deployment is when I was like, I'm done.
I think what was funny is like that the deployment that you were on, where we both sort of crossed paths. We lived in the same mm-hmm. forward operating base. I really wasn't well there.
Yeah.
And you could probably see it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I think we were down the same path.
Yeah.
I feel like we're pretty close.
100%. And after that deployment finished, I was in such a bad place. She was like, you need to come home and mm-hmm. be with me, as in mum needs to sort of try and help you. Because she did some course in mental health, because she works with veterans and stuff, and she could see it. And that's where we went down the sort of therapy dog route, where I got my dog, and he literally squared me away in 4 months. I was good to go. But it's worked out for the best, which is what it's all about, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, like, I didn't really start displaying any serious outward issues to uh-huh. anyone until after my second deployment.
Yeah.
Because I was using. So my first deployment, I was shot.
Mm-hmm.
In my vest.
Oh shit!
And the vest stopped everything.
Uh-huh.
But I fell, and when I fell, I tore out my rotator cuff.
Right.
So they had me stay in Iraq for the rest of the deployment, and then when I got home, I had surgery. So what while I was hell? In Iraq, yeah, they just pumped me full of Percocet the entire time I was in Iraq. So, yeah. First off, can you imagine the heat with all that opiates running through your body? Like, it was miserable, man. I was puking nonstop.
You went through some water, right?
Oh, yeah. Lots. Lots. And so I got back home, and they gave me surgery, but they kept throwing pills at me.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, I wasn't in that world for a year, year and a half. So I was deployed, and I left that life.
Yeah, yeah.
But here they are, they're like, take it. This is how you stay functional. This is how you stay in the fight.
Yeah.
And I'm indoctrinated. I'm like, okay, fuck yeah, they're giving me this shit to stay in the fight. Let's do this.
And it's legal. Good to go.
Mm-hmm. So by the time I got to my second deployment, I was receiving lots of pain medication still.
Yeah.
And they gave me, you know, 6 month supply to take to Iraq with me.
Fuck.
And yeah, it was ridiculous. And sure as shit, that supply wasn't going to last.
It never does.
So, you know, you get to Iraq, the second deployment, and 2 months into it, I'm out.
Yeah.
And I have no choice but to go through that whole process and kick the withdrawal and kick that habit and get on the right path again. So I do. But then my shoulder starts hurting more and then going and all that shit. It was just a mess.
I think your dog's kicking my dog off. Your dog barked, my dog barked. Sorry, go on.
No, you're good. Yeah, so it's just been, for me, it's been, it all started, my childhood traumas led into drug use.
Uh-huh.
And then the drug use made me more susceptible to depression and PTSD than I would have been had I not been using, right? You know, and there were times where I was straight for 2 or 3 years while I was in the Army.
Yeah.
But then something would happen, and then they would give me more pills, and that would set me off. And the fucked up thing was, I went to counseling, and I told them, like, hey, I can't have this.
Yeah.
I can't have this medication. And it was in my file.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Thing that shows, like, hey, don't give this guy this medication. And they just continue to do it.
Fuck.
I mean, granted, I was seeking it at times.
Sure.
But, you know.
Were you seeking it as a coping mechanism? Or,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, it took away the pain physically and emotionally.
Uh-huh.
You know, it
numbs you. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Once I realized it numbed me out and I could just focus on the objective, rock on, let's do this. You know, and once I got to Afghanistan, it made it even worse, you know, because I was right there.
Yeah.
So my second deployment, I actually is when I got involved in the intel side of things.
Yeah.
And I think that was the beginning of my downfall.
Okay.
You know, my second deployment, I became a linguist manager, and then I became what's called a COIST manager, which is company level intelligence support team.
Yep.
So managing the linguists and running the intelligence collections of the company, it gave me a unique point of view to see what was going on and how the interpreters were involved in certain things. And you know, we were getting hit periodically, but it always seemed when this linguist wasn't around.
Right.
And it was one that was always supposed to go on this route, never showed up. When he wouldn't show up, we would get hit. It was like made total sense. So one night he didn't show up, we get hit, they take some casualties, no one died, but there were some injuries. And from that point on, I was like, I fucking was headhunting this guy. He showed up back on base like 2 weeks later. We rolled him up. He got sent to jail, tried and all that shit. But that was the beginning of me wanting to do counterintelligence work.
Right.
Right. So from that point, doing the company level intelligence stuff, the brigade asset or the brigade asset manager saw me, was like, hey, you'd be a real good fit for this program. Go apply. I applied, I got accepted, and then I got into full-blown intelligence collection for the Department of Defense.
Awesome.
So I left my second deployment early to go back to the stateside to go to school and train for the new career path. I became a counterintelligence agent in 2009, and from that point on, I was in training for like 2 years. So the training consisted of me going to Fort Huachuca in Arizona, doing basic intel counterintelligence collection training. Then I went to Virginia to the farm, Camp Perry. And then we did some work up in West Virginia as well, mountains. You know, it was – that was an ego booster, man.
I can imagine.
Go through that stuff and to see – yourself coming from the environment I came from,
100%,
and being around all these alpha males,
that
are giants to me. I'm walking with giants right now, so my ego just went through the roof. And I'm sure when you met me in Afghanistan, you could probably catch some of that sometimes. You know,
there's nothing wrong with having an ego. It's where the ego turns to arrogance is where an issue. But I never saw that. I saw the ego in confidence as opposed to arrogance.
Well, thank you. you saw an ego hidden by lots of drugs. So I got, after all that training, I was sent to Afghanistan on a small team to help counter poppy proliferation.
Yep.
And we started doing some eradication missions.
Yep.
And, you know, I think that was the beginning for me was when I saw that my people weren't doing exactly what they said they were doing, right. And that we aren't necessarily living up to the American standard, so to speak. And with that, you know, there's all kinds of reasonings for doing what, you know, certain commands did or, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, when we would go out and eradicate these things, these fields, we were very selective.
Sure.
And we didn't eradicate everything.
Yeah.
And I can't validate why we didn't, but I know we didn't. And coming from a nation that is experiencing an opiate epidemic unparalleled to anything we've ever seen before.
Yeah.
And from someone who has witnessed it personally, who's dealt with it personally, who has watched their family get destroyed by it.
Yeah.
I can only assume what I assume.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And it's a sad thing. It's very, very sad that...
Not only that, you're privy to certain information that others aren't, and it opens your eyes, and you're like, fuck.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And I'll tell you, I wouldn't say it's privy to information that other people aren't, because I think that information is out there. Mm-hmm. I think everyone knows it. They're just not willing to really look at it.
Or accept it.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. Because it's blatant. Once you see it, it's obvious.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, obviously. That makes total sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, I challenge people that listen to these things in the future to really dig a little deeper and look a little, turn a couple more pages.
Yeah.
It might be beneficial for everyone.
Yeah. Don't just look at the first Google page.
Yeah. Go a little deeper, for sure. You know, and so I got to Afghanistan. And so after that poppy eradication mission, it was only a 3-month rotation.
Yeah.
I come back. And I couldn't wait to get back to Afghanistan. I was hooked.
Yeah.
Like that op tempo, that move on the jump constantly.
100%.
So I couldn't get away from it. So they sent me right back. I was back in Afghanistan within 30 days.
Did you ask for that? Did they know that you were just
absolutely,
like?
Absolutely. Yeah. And they sent me right back.
And they were happy to do that after a year's deployment. And they were happy to do that.
No, it was 3 months.
Oh, three so months. Okay, my bad.
3 months on the poppy eradication. Uh-huh. So when we came back, I was. Within a month, I was back in Afghanistan on a counterintelligence green on blue
right
program.
Yeah.
So at that time.
So just for the listeners, you explain what green on blue is, just for.
So green on blue is essentially green forces is referencing the Afghan populace.
Yeah.
And blue is referencing U.S. populace or coalition forces.
Yeah.
And typically during that time in Afghanistan, a lot of Afghan national soldiers were turning on coalition forces, American forces, Brit forces, and killing them.
Uh-huh.
So they sent in groups of counterintelligence agents from Brits, from everyone in the coalition, sent in assets to help, you know, counter that.
Sure.
And I don't know how successful it was. But I know that we got a lot of other work done that being beneficial. And I think, you know, for me, that's when my drug use got to the most.
Wow.
Actually, while I was there in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning of my hardcore downfall.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm running sources, I'm running assets, collecting information. These guys are, you know, warlords, they're narco lords, they're people that high up in their world. They have access to a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? It wasn't much for me to say, hey, guy, next on your next trip, maybe you should bring back a couple grams of heroin with you. And sure as shit, they would do it. And so I had my assets bringing me drugs. Like I was not doing the right thing for a little while.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I did what I needed to do to feed my habit
and survive
and keep my mind fucking level. So I didn't go off and kill everyone on the space. Like I was in a bad spot, a really bad spot for a little while. I'm surprised no one really saw how bad it was getting. You know, I remember one time I fucking went out, I ran out and I started to get sick.
Yeah.
And I called up one of my sources. He got in his car and drove to our base to drop off some shit for me.
Oh, fucking hell.
Now, the base I was at, I had to go outside one gate. Travel through the Afghan base to get to their gate.
Right.
Right? Now, when you got to their gate, there was armed security at their gate, and they didn't let anyone in or out. They were guns drawn the moment they saw a vehicle because of, you know, the temper in Afghanistan at the time. So I roll up to the gate. They draw out on me. and they're like, get out of the car, get out of there, yelling at me, and I can't understand what the fuck's going on. And then my dude pulls up, and he's like, I have medicine for my friend, and he gets the guns drawn on him, and we were able to talk our way out of the situation, but now I'm driving back to base, right?
Yeah.
I couldn't wait to get back to my chew to get right.
Yeah.
So I rolled up a bill, put it in this bag, and hit it right there while I'm driving back to base. The bill gets clogged, right? So now it's packed full of dope.
Yeah.
And I bang it out, and I'm wearing windbreaker pants.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's powder all over my windbreaker pants, and it's like stuck inside material. Like I can't, it's just there, right?
Yeah.
So I'm freaking out because I got to go through security when I go back to the base. Like they're going to check the car. Luckily, because I was who I was, when I went back through security, they didn't check. They just waved me through.
Yeah.
I go back to my base, like to my chew.
Mm-hmm.
I go to my room, and the first thing I do, like I look at myself, and I'm like, bro, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Do you not realize like what you just did? There could have been so many bad things that stemmed from that.
Yeah.
You know? And from that point, that was the last time I did anything that crazy.
Yeah.
But it didn't stop me.
Yeah.
You know? Then I'd have shopkeepers bringing me shit, and like it was a mess, dude. Mm-hmm. It was total mayhem, and it was to do what honestly, like I thought I was doing what was right. Like I thought in my mind that this is what I needed to do to continue this mission and stop these bad guys from doing this shit.
The army's complicit in this because you've actively said, do not give me these pain relief because you know it's not good for you mentally, physically.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they've just been throwing them at you to say, you know, just take what you need to take to fucking achieve the mission.
Right. You know, with these effects lists and identifying who was no longer going to be allowed in battle space and
uh-huh.
who wasn't,
uh-huh.
Identifying what persons were going to be removed, the time and day they were going to be removed mm-hmm. without them knowing it,
mm-hmm.
Started to play a significant role in my brain. And emotionally, mentally, it was just, here I am playing God, essentially, right?
Yeah, like, sure.
We are with building these lives. Targeting packets.
Yeah.
We're deciding when someone's allowed to live or not before they know it.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's something that in the beginning was fun to me because we would watch it on Kill TV.
Sure.
You know, like, you would write the script and the guys with the cameras would make it real, you know, and it seemed like a fucking movie or a video game.
Yeah.
And after a while, it just started to see it for what it was. And we are removing lives.
Mm-hmm.
That's not my fucking role, man. I can't do that.
Yeah.
Like, can't.
Yeah.
So from that point, it was just maintain, just keep my head above water.
Mm-hmm. So what year did you leave? Because obviously we last saw each other in 2014.
Yeah, 2014. Yeah, so that
December,
was like
December, said, December 5th, December 14, was it?
March 14.
March 14.
I left in March 14th.
It was March 14,
then,
yeah.
And then the second half of the team stayed behind.
Uh-huh.
And you probably remember them sticking around.
Yeah.
That rotation I built some serious friendships on that rotation.
Yeah.
Some long-lasting friendships, 100%. I think, given the environment that we were in,
uh-huh.
the close proximity and the operations, it was a good time.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just unfortunate that my professional side led me down the paths that it did.
Well, you know, it is what it is. And you just fucking...
Oh, sure.
You roll with what you got, and that's it.
Absolutely.
You know, and look at you now, you know?
Yeah, and that's something that I try not to actually think about too much
because
I think it might make me arrogant, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I've come this far, fuck, uh-huh. I can do whatever I want now.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I got out of the Army in 2015, and right before I got out, I actually tried to commit suicide.
Oh, fuck, bro.
And I loaded up a bunch of fentanyl.
Yeah.
And tried to kill myself with it.
Fuck, bro.
And instead of it killing me, it... put me in a coma.
Yeah.
And
I didn't know this.
Yeah.
I didn't know any of this.
Not a lot of people do.
Mm.
And I ended up going to a PTSD treatment facility for 30 days after that.
Yeah.
And from that point on, I understood that I wasn't right. Like my fucking head was bonkers.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the drug use, the anger, the aggression.
Yeah.
All of that was stemming from childhood trauma made worse and compacted by everything I was doing in war.
Yeah.
Once I learned that, it was kind of like a light switch for me, you know? I got out of the military right after that, and I stopped taking all the pharmaceuticals they were giving me because it was making the suicidal ideations and the depression far, far worse.
Uh-huh.
I started using cannabis, and from that point, I found my answer. And I felt, you know, not just the use of the plant, but the growing of it too, just it grounded me and it made me, it brought me back to who I was.
Yeah.
Once I found that clarity, I was like, fuck, everybody should have this opportunity. I have to show this to everyone, you know, like fucking a religious friar going around and speaking the word, you know, like, have you tried this plant? Have you smoked this? Do you know what it can do? You know, and from that point, like, I dedicated all my time into it. Luckily, the Department of Defense realized that I was sick and they allowed me to medically discharge.
Right.
And now I collect, you know, I was collecting disability from the VA for a little while that allowed me to focus all my time and energy into learning this plant, learning how to grow it, learning how to extract it. And I've dedicated all my time to cannabis now.
What is the VA and Veterans Association, is that right? What does it stand for? VA?
Administration.
Administration. So just for the UK listeners, I mean, the US listeners will probably know what it is, but for the UK listeners, what is the VA and what's its purpose and what does it do and who's it funded by?
So the VA is a veterans administration. It is set up by the US government to help take care of veterans post-war or post when they stop serving.
Right.
It is a government-run organization. It's not privatized.
Yep.
So our taxpayer dollars go to funding it. It is not run in the best way.
Yeah.
Veterans aren't getting the care that they need from it. And it's a very, very sad disarray right now.
Yeah.
Man,
yeah.
It's they throw money at veterans and think that they can, that's enough. You know, then go take care of yourself. But
yeah.
That's just their living. They still have to take care of, you know, everything else. And, you know, we have soldiers or veterans killing themselves in the parking lots of these VAs because they're not able to get the help that they need.
Yeah,
you know,
shocking.
It's very, very sad. I don't know how it is over there in the UK.
So
I hope you guys get better treatment than we do.
I mean, over here, unfortunately, veterans have to rely on charities to support them.
Really?
Yeah. Anywhere through mental health through to actual physical. So, like, There's charities called Help for Heroes, and that literally works off the public donations. I'm talking from a veteran now. Like, you get treated the same as everyone else, and I'm not looking for special treatment, but you need a different type of treatment from the norm. So PTSD for me, like PTSD from service should be treated differently to normal civilian PTSD because they're completely different. They stem from completely different origins to start with.
Absolutely.
And, you know, anyone injured in service should be catered for, you know, in the best possible way.
Right.
And they're not. And it's down to charities to do that. Like my friend Simo, who lost his legs and half a hand, if it wasn't for Help for Heroes, he wouldn't have a car that's adapted to his needs.
Right.
They'd say, well, just get the fucking bus.
Right. Okay.
You know?
Wow.
So
I feel bad for bitching about our situation, though, because we have more than you. You know, at the end of the day, like, we have veterans that get monthly stipends because of their service.
Yeah.
You know, so they are being taken care of in some aspect.
So you left the military and you went to the cannabis side of things. And you've got a quite successful little business going on?
Yeah, I would say we're doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we
very modest.
Yeah. So it's I'd say right now we bring in about 45,000 US a month.
Yep.
Well, there's lots of overhead, man.
Of course. Yeah.
It's, you know, it's doing good. But the best thing is that I'm able to provide medicine to people who need it and who can't afford it, you know?
100%.
At the end of the day, the cannabis boom in the States has priced out a lot of people. Mm-hmm. They just can't afford to go the traditional routes to get their medication, you know? So if we bottle something up and put it on a shelf and it sells for $50, so everyone in that path line makes their cut, that person can't afford it now.
No, that is natural, you know. It's possibly the most natural medication you can get.
Yep. And that's why, you know, if for us, we make sure that if you need it, you get it.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. Uh-huh. If you can't afford it, we'll figure this shit out. And we'll make sure you have the medicine that you need.
Yeah.
Because there's no need to suffer anymore.
Yeah.
It grows everywhere around us.
I mean,
I can teach you to make it yourself.
The amount of guys who I've served with who quite blatantly have PTSD, but they haven't gone down the medical route in terms of getting these crazy ass fucking drugs from the doctor who just turn them into zombies.
Yeah.
But they've gone down the CBD route and they say their lives have literally been turned around within a week.
Yep.
Within a week of CBD.
I believe it.
And I've got friends who have gone down the medical route and are worse now than they were before these sort of zombifying pharmaceutical drugs.
Yes, sir.
You know?
That's how I was. I was the same. I was the guy. Period. And the plant, the moment I tried it for the first time, like for medicinal reasons, I knew right away this was it.
Yeah.
Like, I have found my answer. I don't need anything else. We're good to go.
Yeah.
And from that point, it's been nonstop. Like
it's almost like like a hallelujah moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. 100%. It's, it was, this is what everyone's been talking about for all these years. This is those, you know, tongue-in-cheek jokes.
It's
legit. It's real.
Yeah.
There's truth to it, you know? And to deny that to anyone at this point is ridiculous to me. And
well, you know,
we fight hard for it.
You know, the big farmers, they've been fighting it for 40 years plus, you know? And I think they've just realised they're fighting a losing battle right now because in the UK, the laws are still really strict, although they've just sanctioned sort of medical use. So it has to be, it'll be like a cannabinoid medication prescribed by a doctor, but he has to go through these steps to prescribe it. But CBD oil is fully legit as long as it's under a THC level percentage. But you know, it's slowly creeping in a way that it can only go forward. It can't go backwards, you know. And it's only a matter of time that, you know, states legalize it for medical research, and it all comes out. I'm a massive advocate for it because I went onto CBD maybe 8 months ago, and sort of little aches and pains that I had. I mean, I've got a massive drama with my hormones, so I'm doing testosterone replacement therapy because my body's not producing enough testosterone. But so at first I thought I was fucking dying of like cancer or some shit because I had a lump in my breast. I was waking up in the morning, so like, you know, when you have the flu. And all your body, your joints and your bones ache every day. I had that. And I found a lump. And you know, you go on Google or you just put two together. You're like, fuck, I'm dying. I'm dead already. So went to the doctors and they went, you've got testosterone of a fucking woman. And I was like, that explains why I cry at fucking commercials about horses on TV. And so, I'm on like testosterone replacement therapy. But I started CBD 8 months ago, so that was like 4 months prior to all this happening. And like aches and pains just disappeared.
Oh yeah, it's just the beginning, I think, for all cannabinoids. You know, it's what I'm working on now at the lab it's taking not just CBD but the other cannabinoids that are non psychoactive and then putting that into a package in one molecule and delivered that as a medicine. Because there's more benefits to this plant than just CBD or THC. You know, there's tons of other cannabinoids that have been proven valuable, and you shouldn't be denied them.
Definitely.
At all. You know, I think the U.S. specifically is about to legalize nationally here in the next year or so. So once we go, I think it'll be domino effect for the rest of the world.
100%. It's going to happen pretty quickly. Do you commercially, do you sell your products commercially worldwide, or is it just stateside?
Yeah, we sell worldwide. It's through, typically you can buy the individual packaged products through our website, amberwingsorganics.com.
I'm on it tonight. Yep.
Yeah, or you can just message me. I'll square you away.
Yeah, yeah. Give me direct message the discount code.
There you go. but we also do white labeling for other products and other companies. You know, there's a large variety of people that don't have access to extraction or formulating or cultivating, but they want to be a part of the movement and sell this product or get it out to communities. So we develop products for them, slap their own label on it, and allow them to sell it at their own pace.
Awesome. That sounds amazing,
there's,
mate.
There's ways for everybody.
Right. I think we're going to business together. That's it.
Right? Get awesome. In on it while it's hot.
That's it. I mean, how are you now in terms of sort of mental health and your sort of self-confessed sort of issue with pharmaceuticals?
So, without my wife, I would not be here. She, I'm stable now, and I understand what my issues were, and I understand that it's a part of life, and that there are ways to develop coping mechanisms, you know, post trauma to help deal with all these problems. And you know, in the beginning, I did use cannabis as a crutch, and I used only cannabis to get me through those things. But once I developed the mental ability to deal with them, then the cannabis use went away, and now I use it therapeutically, and it's not as much the maintenance as opposed to every now and then when it's needed, right? So mentally, I think that there's still work to be done, obviously. I think everyone needs to continue that path and get better. But I don't struggle with the night terrors, the night sweats, the you know, fits of rage, the breaking random shit, the wanting to smash people's head through a wall. That doesn't happen anymore.
We're looking at coming over to the US next year, a little family holiday, a little, should I say, vacation, to Florida.
Okay.
Excuse my ignorance, but how far away is that from you?
Oh, that's a good flight.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's easy to do. Yeah, not a problem. I got family that lives down there.
Okay. So we'll definitely sort something out, whether I might jump on a flight, even if it's for a day or so, and I'll...
No, we'll calm down. It'd be better to go down to Florida. Yeah.
Well, it's been a brilliant chat, mate. Thank you so much for this. What's your company called again?
Amber Wings Organics.
Amber Wing Organics. Okay, just put that on there. So I just...
I'll send you a message too with it on there, just so you have it.
Awesome.
I'll type it in there.
Sweet. Well, thank you very much, and I hope you all enjoyed it.
All right, man. Thanks. I appreciate it. Take care.